welcome to today's broadcast. Hope you're having a fantastic Super Bowl Sunday. Thank you for joining me today. As always, I am your ever so humble host, Tim Tapp, coming to you live from historic Roane County, Tennessee. Off the top, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl. I want to try and take just a quick glance at it from the standpoint of what it has become as far as a social event within our culture. It is unquestionably the most highly anticipated sporting event and one of the most highly watched events on television, period. But it transcends just that of sports fandom. It goes beyond that of just the folks who enjoy the NFL in particularly, or football in general. It's become something else in our culture. It's become a celebration of, a celebration of abundance as much as anything. What we see playing out in front of us, despite controversy around possible health ramifications, in particularly that of concussions, especially being highlighted with the relatively recent release of the Will Smith movie. A lot of critics to the game. A lot of people are anti-football, period. But none of that's really relevant to what the Super Bowl has become in our culture. It's become about the commercials. We get to see these great commercials. Everybody's been working on programs since last year what their new Super Bowl commercials are going to be. And they wait and they release them for the multi-million dollar time slots, although most of them leak to the internet now, and we have seen the majority of them if you care to take a look at them. Most years, I have to admit, the last several years, in fact, I have watched as many of them that have leaked as possible so I could talk about it here on the show beforehand, because almost without question, there is at least one or two that has some type of political or cultural relevance that needs to be discussed. It's just the way it is. This happens every year. But this year, I have not cheated. I haven't looked ahead. So I'll be seeing each one of these brand new right off the top of the bat. Yeah, so I will get that impression for the first time, seeing them as they air. Before that, though, I continue to see our culture kind of slip away, if you will, from where we had been as far as what defined America. And we see this played out very clearly with what passes for an entertaining commercial, whether it's the attacks on fatherhood that we see quite often, where the mother has to take care of the household because the father is, you know, incapable of this, incapable of that, so on and so forth. So undoubtedly, we will see something further this year. There will be a controversial commercial. Some of you who have already watched some of these early leaked commercials may already know what the more controversial ones are going to be. And in that fact, just know that you're ahead of me right now. I have not cheated this year. I'm going to be watching them. And just as an aside to how ingrained this has become as part of our society, my wife and my daughters are insistent on having a Super Bowl party here. They don't typically watch a lot of football, though my wife is not anti-football the way a lot of people tend to be on occasion. But she doesn't watch a lot of sports. She'll watch football, she'll watch basketball, that's about the extent of it. She doesn't watch a lot of it, and usually there has to be, in order for her to pay attention to it, a direct connection of some kind. For us, the direct connection is me being a University of Tennessee fan. Peyton Manning is, of course, former Volunteer, and so we're kind of rooting for the Broncos in this case. Love for Peyton, as it's whether this is his last game or not, it's clear he doesn't have too many more seasons left in him. Would love for him to have an opportunity to go out on top. He's going to have his hands full with Carolina. There's no question about that. But all of that is a side note. The important thing is that I'm going to have an opportunity to spend time with my family doing something that ordinarily they would not be involved with. They don't get excited about UT football games the way that I do. Beyond that, there is something particularly Americana about football and basketball in particular. And you can say the same thing for baseball. But aside from that exuberance and that celebration of excess that I was talking about, where we get to see people get paid millions of dollars to play a child's game, we also get to see human character on display. And nothing reveals character quite like athletics. If you're part of a team over the course of a season, that character will shine through. The resilience of certain athletes, the willingness to push through physical adversity, emotional adversity, fighting in a metaphorical sense to advance the team. While at the same time, you also get revealed how individuals will approach life. You'll see who is willing to be part of the team, who's willing to give up part of their individual potential acolytes in order to best help the team. You get to see all those things on display. And I am a firm believer in athletics as being a positive thing for kids. There's a lot of great life lessons that can be taught. Unfortunately, I have to say can be, because it obviously is not always. We see that in prima donna athletes that make it to the professional level. Unfortunately, it can be a conduit for bad behavior as much as anything else. But for most people, participation in athletics, even at a community center, youth league level type setting, can be very instructional as far as life lessons. You're forced to learn to work with others, even if it's someone you may not necessarily like a great deal. You're forced to learn that if you want the results, that you have to put in the effort. You have to work harder at getting better if you want to get better, regardless of the rest of the team. You also learn how to deal with disappointment. Most people are on teams that will lose at some point, even if they're on some of the best teams that are available. There's a lot of positives that's associated with athletes. And we'll get to see some of that on display, some of all of that on display a little bit later today, which brings me to the point that I will be ending the show early today so that I can spend that time with my family a little bit later. So we're looking at about an hour-long show. And here in a little bit, about 3:30, Ken Crow will be joining us, and we'll take a look at what happened in Iowa, what we can expect in New Hampshire. You know, the primary season is well underway at this point. And, you know, it's officially begun. And that is, it's a great thing because, again, you start seeing people drop out. The field will narrow. Now, the Democrats are pretty much already down to just Hillary and Bernie Sanders, which I think we knew it was pretty much that way for a while anyway. There were three or four people on the stage for some of the debates, but that's done now. You got to, and I know there's a lot of Democrats really desperately looking for another option. They can't get too excited about Bernie because they're afraid about Bernie and the national. They can't get excited about Hillary because, well, let's face facts, for the most part, there's not a lot of people that like Hillary. They don't get excited about wanting to vote for her. You know, there's several Democrats, they'll deny it. But let's face facts, if they could get behind Hillary, if they were excited about Hillary, Barack Hussein Alu Akbar Obama would not have upended her last time she ran. Wouldn't have been possible. You know, I've made that assertion on several occasions, and I think it's a solid, legitimate observation. And I haven't heard too many people deny it outside of Democrats who are firmly drinking the Kool-Aid. But be that as it may, there's another aspect of what transpired. Excuse me. In the Republican side of things, we did have Rick Santorum officially drop out over the course of the past week. We had Mike Huckabee officially drop out. But we also had some nastiness take place, in so much as some of the Ted Cruz people got a little overzealous and they began sending out an announcement that it looked like Ben Carson was getting out of the race. And supposedly this was the result of something that CNN was reporting. And, you know, evidently they did report that it looked like Ben would not be going to New Hampshire or South Carolina, which is kind of weird. But as far as what was being reported on air and then in comparison to what was being tweeted out by the news service via their Twitter account, they corrected it rather quickly, but they didn't do so on air. And the Cruz campaign is blaming CNN for them sending that message out. Ben Carson, of course, feels like that cost him votes, cost him opportunity to finish stronger. And, I don't know necessarily that helped the Cruz campaign in particular. And I don't think people that were supporting Carson would automatically be swayed to Cruz. Maybe about half of them. The rest of them, I think, would have been split up in different ways, but it's still an interesting story, and we'll get into that a little bit more also. We've seen a lot of bitter grapes from Trump. He started out very gracious, claiming happy to be finished second, and then as the week went on, it became obvious he wasn't particularly happy about not winning, which, you know, you shouldn't be happy about a second-place finish unless you weren't expected to finish in the top three. When you're the front runner, you want to try and win. But we all know things taking place in Iowa would be different than what we could expect in other primaries. But here's the other thing. You know, Marco Rubio seems to have picked up a lot of steam. He may have undone a lot of that steam in last night's Republican debate in New Hampshire because he didn't have a particularly good debate, and while everyone was expecting his former mentor, Jeb Bush, to be the one pushing the buttons there, it was actually Chris Christie that was on the attack and absolutely torpedoing Marco Rubio. And, you know, the Chris Christie we saw last night, if that had been the Chris Christie that had been on the attack since the beginning of the process, Christie may have had an opportunity to win over a lot more voters. I think at this stage in the game, not that many people are ready to make that switch over. I think most folks have made up their mind at this point. And in fact, every time I hear somebody talk about how many undecideds there really are, I wonder if that's an accurate assessment. But then again, I know the folks that I talk to on a regular basis are locked into politics. And I know there are a ton of people who are not. So maybe, sadly enough, he might have ignited his own campaign again, because let's face facts, Iowa is a good thing as far as we see donation money start to dry up, the field narrows. New Hampshire's the same thing. Again, you've got a very different cross-section of Americans. So you're not going to see what overall America is ready for in either one of these primaries. But what you are going to see is the field narrow, and we will get down to just two or three in a short period of time. I'd be very surprised if we have more than three candidates by the time South Carolina is over. All of that having been said, though, according to Ken Crow, and what he's been talking about, is that the media is not really telling us everything that actually did happen in Iowa and how the situation there may not be a done deal just yet. So when he comes on, we'll talk about that. In the meanwhile, the fact that we'll be talking about that later and that I'm only going to be on roughly about an hour, I decided to go ahead and do the headlines you may have missed segment. We definitely want to get that in because this is actually a leftover from last week. Last week we did not get to everything because of the nature of how the show ran. But I definitely wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk about this. This is from the headlines you may have missed. And from what I've managed to gather, unless you happen to be paying close attention or unless you happen to check out the Tap Into the Truth Facebook page where I linked this last week, you may not have heard this one even now a week later. And usually I'm far enough ahead of the curve that we get these in pretty early, but it seems that a UN group says that the U.S. should consider reparations, that the United States should think reparations to African-American descendants of slavery is something we should do. At least that's what this particular group says. According to a story that was filed by the AP, the United States should consider reparations to African-American descendants of slavery, establish a national human rights commission, and publicly acknowledge that the transatlantic slave trade was a crime against humanity. Now, this is something that, of course, we've heard before, but it's not been an official UN recommendation before. Now, the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, yes, that is an actual subcommittee being headed up at the UN. That's the name, the UN Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent. They released its preliminary recommendations after more than a week of meetings with Black Americans and others. Be real interested as to who these others might be. Anyway, Black Americans and others from around the country, including such vestiges of common sense as Baltimore, Chicago, New York City, the District of Columbia, and Jackson, Mississippi. One of these is not like the others, although they do share a few things in common, I suppose. After finishing their fact-finding mission, the working group was extremely concerned about the human rights situation of African Americans. Now, the chair of this group, a Michelle Ferran Mendez of France, happened to say in the report, quote, "The colonial history, the legacy of enslavement, racial subordination and segregation, racial terrorism, and racial inequality in the U.S. remains a serious challenge as there has been no real commitment to reparations and to truth and reconciliation for people of African descent." Now, for example, she compared the recent deaths of unarmed Black men like Michael Brown and Eric Garner at the hands of police to the lynching of Black men in the South from the post-Civil War days through the Civil Rights era. Those deaths and others have inspired protests around the country under the Black Lives Matter moniker. contemporary police killings and the trauma it creates are reminiscent of the racial terror lynchings in the past. Impunity for state violence has resulted in the current human rights crisis and must be addressed as a matter of urgency. Now, some of the working group's members, none of whom are from the United States, surprise, surprise, said they were shocked by some of the things they found and were told. For example, quote, "It's very easy in the United States for African Americans to be imprisoned, and that was very concerning." This from, I'm not even going to attempt the name, but he's from South Africa. I'm surprised that they find it surprising that people can be easily incarcerated, considering South Africa's own history. But at any rate, federal officials say that 37% of the state and federal prison populations were black males in 2014. The working group suggests the U.S. implement several reforms, including reducing the use of mandatory minimum laws, ending racial profiling, ending excessive bail, and banning solitary confinement. Although I'm under the impression that at lots of occasions, solitary confinement is as much about protecting the inmate as it is anything else, at least in about half of the occasions. At any rate, I continue. What stands out is the lack of acknowledgement of the slave trade. According to Ricardo A. Sonja III, who lives in the Philippines, the working group suggests monuments, markers, and memorials be erected in the United States to facilitate dialogue and past injustices and crimes against African Americans need to be addressed with reparatory justice. Reparatory justice. The group will suggest several U.S. changes to improve human rights for African Americans, which also includes establishing a National Human Rights Commission, ratifying international human rights treaties, asking Congress to study slavery and its after effects, and considering reparations. The Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent was established in 2002 by the then Commission on Human Rights, following the World Conference Against Racism back in 2001. It also visited the United States in 2010, where its final report found similar problems, including blacks facing disproportionately high unemployment, lower income levels, less access to education, problematic access to quality health care services, and the high incidence of certain health conditions, electoral disenfranchisement, and structural issues in the administration of justice, specifically focusing on the incarceration rates. The current panel will give its final findings to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva this upcoming September. But here's the thing. When it comes to this group, I think they're really missing the point. I mean, the UN itself should be far more concerned with working to end slavery worldwide today rather than focusing on something that ended in this country over a century ago, well over a century ago. Despite the many racial issues that we have faced, and I admit there are several. We have had times where tension was very high. We've had occasions where there was still a certain amount of institutional racism. I mean, you can't deny those things. Prior to Barack Obama's election, I think that race relations actually had reached new levels of positive. I don't understand how Barack Obama seems to have decided that by ignoring black crime and only focusing on punishing white people, which seems to be the primary focus of the Justice Department, anything that reaches the level that comes across their desk, that somehow would make up for the wrongs of the past, when all it has done is it's incited anger and it's created a new level of racial tension that hasn't existed in this country since pre-Civil War. But if I'm the UN, I'm more worried about ending slavery now. Slavery that's going on all around the world, and not just at the hands of our favorite 7th century blackguards, the members of ISIS. Slavery is a common practice within Islam and occurs in nations where Sharia is the law. But there are other places where slavery still occurs. Whether it's legal or not, no law enforcement tries to stop them. That should be the focal point if you're the UN. That's where I would say we need to take care of this first. If you genuinely think that you can question the human rights legacy and the human rights record of the United States of America, you've got some issues. But I'll go one better. Despite all of our racial issues that we have had, legitimately, that we've fought our way through, at the end of the Civil War, choice was made, and citizenship was granted to those who had been forced here. The same choice could have been made to send them back to their native lands. Now, nobody wanted to do that. It would have been expensive. But the bottom line is that could have occurred. I would suggest quite clearly that being made a citizen of this country is the greatest reparation that could be made, that is valued far beyond any propensity amount that you might offer. Cash is not worth citizenship in this country. And anyone that doesn't feel like their citizenship is worth more than any amount, dollar amount that you could find in reparations, then maybe you should consider leaving. Because if it's so bad here, why stay? Now, I know that sounds like I'm not particularly sensitive to the plight. But I've known a lot of people that fit into that bill who are just good people. They're working hard. They're trying to make a living. And they're not interested in reparations as much as they are interested in a fair shake. Everybody wants a fair shake, but in order to get that fair shake, you have to take advantage of the opportunities that are available. And when you see somebody like a Dr. Ben Carson, then it's pretty clear that those opportunities are there. You just have to be willing to take them. All right. With me now, being joined by Ken Crow, and we're just going to jump right into the topic today. How are you today, Ken?
Well, good afternoon. Happy Super Bowl 50 to you, Tim. Great to be here.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. All right.
Listen, Mama's in the kitchen cooking the little Smokies and all of the fire-breathing chicken wings, and we're getting set up for a big party a little bit later. My Denver Broncos are going to go lose in dramatic fashion to Cam Newton. He's a one-man wrecking crew, you know. He doesn't need the rest of the team. He's the only guy that needs to show up.
Well, I got to tell you, Being right here in the heart of SEC country, I got to see Cam play at Auburn, and you know, he was that last year he was down there. He's doing all the same things he's doing in the NFL, all those things that you're told you can't do in the NFL as a quarterback. He's doing them, and yeah, it provides a lot of versatility. But yeah, I still have to root for my boy. Came here to UT, Peyton. Peyton is as healthy as he's been all year. He finds a way to win, and he's well-rested. And what I really like in this matchup, though, is that the Broncos' defense, if anybody's going to match up and actually be able to contain Carolina, the Broncos have the best chance at it. So we should see some pretty good football, I think.
Well, I'm with you. I lived for 9 years there in Knoxville when Peyton was playing. And I'll never forget, I'm going to tell you one quick anecdote about that guy. You may have heard it before, I don't know. But he was in his senior year at Tennessee, and my children came home one day. I don't know, it was like the third day of school or something, and one was in the first grade, the other was in the third grade or whatever it was, I don't remember. But as you know, he stayed for 5 years at Tennessee. He didn't leave when he could have. He ended up staying another year. And he used to go by the elementary schools. And I didn't know this, but my sons came home. One of them had an autographed, I don't know, it was like a little rubber football, and another one had it. But he used to go by the schools, and he'd just walk into the classrooms on his day off, like on a Friday. He didn't have any classes. And he would take it upon his own accord. Here's a college kid that could have been out. Yeah, I'm sure he probably had girls lined up around the block wanting to date him. But instead of doing that, he'd actually go to the schools and visit with the kids and walk into the classrooms. And I asked my son, I said, what did he talk about? Well, he told us to stay in school, told us not to do drugs, told us to mind our parents, study hard, and someday maybe we could play football too like he does. And he'd go by and give little speeches all on his own accord. And I found that just be remarkable. That whole family's remarkable like that. He is just truly a classy, classy guy. Whether he wins or loses today, I'm going to be rooting for him because I love him like you do. I hope he doesn't get hurt. Hope he does well. But I'm also a realist. The guy's 39 years old. He's got some injuries. He's, you know, can't throw the football like he used to. But he's definitely my sentimental favorite today. So
yeah. You know, I can't help but root for him just as much because he is a guy, like you said, he's a class act. He's done things the right way. He continues to work with the children's hospitals down here whenever he can. I know he's still at the children's hospital in Indianapolis from when he was with the Colts. He still spends time there too. Once he makes a commitment to a community, he continues that commitment. He's just a great guy. You know, he's the kind of athlete that I wish we had more of. He's a good ambassador to the game.
Yeah. Johnny Manziel would do really well to go to the Peyton Manning School of Class before it's too late, because he's throwing away a career, and he could have been like Peyton. And he's throwing it away because he's stupid. Anyway, I didn't call to talk football. You don't want to talk football, but it's kind of hard not to. Day like today, but we had an interesting week this week in Iowa, as you're aware. it's been an interesting week, to say the least, and there's quite a bit going on, still going on. It seems our Secretary of State's now involved in the Ted Cruz, Dr. Carson debacle. And I'm not sure what they're going to end up doing with that, but I do know the Secretary of State is involved, and he is not a happy camper. And Paul Pates, his name, and I've met him several times, and I know many of his staff members. And I know the former Secretary of State pretty well, and he's a friend of mine. And none of them are happy. Apparently what Cruz did was just flat, dirty politics. Because, see, the caucus process, how much do you really know about the caucus process?
I don't know.
I'm asking. Because a lot of people don't really understand it. That's why I'm...
Right. Well, just go right ahead. In case somebody's listening to that,
okay.
Go right ahead.
All right. What they do at a caucus is different than a primary. The results are similar, but they're not. Because what can happen at a caucus is you go to a caucus is where everybody in that voting precinct or area, however they've got it chopped up, will go into a room, or in our case, well, I live in a town of a little over 5,000. We had two caucus sites in town. It was the high school gymnasium and the middle school gymnasium. And everybody from my voting precinct, we were in there with precinct 1, 2, and 3 or something, and the high school had the other precincts. And you go in, and each campaign will appoint a spokesperson, usually the in this case, for Mr. Trump, they had selected a young lady that was a school teacher that they wanted her to speak on his behalf. Interestingly enough, the Carly Fiorina camp didn't have anybody there to speak for them. So any citizen could have said, hey, I want to speak for Carly. Jeb, that's exactly what happened with Jeb. They didn't have anybody there for him. The campaign didn't. Marco Rubio, interestingly enough, they had flown a staffer out of Arkansas up here that was actually at my little caucus. We had about 400 people there. And he actually spoke. He was from Northwest Arkansas. So anyway, what happens is each camp or candidate will have somebody stand up and speak on their behalf. Whereas a primary, you just go in, give your voter card, go to the booth, check off your box or pull the lever, whatever, and you're done. At a caucus, you actually listen to the speeches, and each candidate will have 1 to 3, sometimes maybe 5 minutes, whatever. The person running the caucus will determine that. And in our case, each candidate had 2 or 3 minutes, whatever it was, to make their case. And you can actually have minds changed at a caucus. Now, this is key, because you can go in with the full intent of, say, voting for Chris Christie in the caucus, okay? And the guy from the Marco Rubio camp stands up, who happens to be your pharmacist, stands up and makes a very compelling argument. Well, you respect your pharmacist. Play golf with him. You're friends with him. You go, huh, I didn't know he was rooting for Marco. He made some really interesting cases for him. You know what, I think I'll vote for Marco. And that's exactly what happens. Your family physician may stand up for Jeb. Your veterinarian may stand up for, and these are all people in your community that you respect, particularly if you're, you know, somebody's not real politically adept. You're a Joe Sixpack kind of middle-class America guy. You really don't have time for politics. But you respect your veterinarian. You respect your son's high school history teacher. And that's what happens, Tim. People stand up. And you can see that's why Iowa polling will be what it is today. And the caucuses, when they're complete, reflect nothing like the polling was, and that's why. Mm-hmm. And it's hard groundwork. It's something that you as a campaign have to really be focused in on and really have a great ground game. And if you don't, you will be taken out to the woodshed. And it doesn't matter how much money you spent on advertising.
Right.
So what happened was Cruz got this memo. They put it out, immediately tweeted it out or sent it out in a text or an email to everyone speaking at the caucuses. Be sure to mention that Dr. Carson's out of the race in your speech. And that's exactly what happened. And anybody that stands up and says differently is not telling the truth, because this went out, what was that, 5:45 or something like that, or maybe it was 6:30, whatever, but it was plenty of time for these people to get the memo, okay, particularly the ones at the bigger caucuses in Des Moines, where right. where they've got 2,000 people in the gym, right? That's a big caucus, and we have plenty of them in Des Moines. And they got the memo, and they stood up, because I've talked to people that were there and listened to it. And instead of talking about how wonderful Cruz was, they spent 15 minutes, or their time, talking about Cruz was a Christian like Carson. Carson met Cruz's values because he was a conservative. So they appealed to that evangelical base, which is so strong in Iowa, and use that as an excuse why the Carson people need to come over to the Cruz camp. I had Carson coming in third in Iowa, not where he did. I was convinced he was going to win third. I actually thought it was going to be Trump, Rubio, and Carson. I honestly thought that Cruz was going to come in fourth in Iowa.
Well, I know I had similar conversations immediately afterwards. Folks asked me if I was surprised by the outcomes. And generally, the only response I had was I was really surprised that Carson didn't place much better than he did, because Carson is the kind of guy that gets those kind of support, the Iowa-type voter. You know, he represents a big chunk towards the evangelicals. And, you know, all the folks that are still looking for an outsider – Do you buy in any at all to the apology that the Cruz camp has put back out? Did you happen to catch last night's debate by any chance?
Yes, sir, I did catch the debate, and I did catch the apology. And no, I don't. It was orchestrated. He's had time to put together his case. I honestly believe that Ted Cruz — this is going to come as a shock to a lot of people — Ted Cruz is nothing more than a right-wing version of Barack Obama, in my opinion. He is the epitome of a smooth talker. This guy, every word is calculated. Everything he says is orchestrated and memorized and rehearsed. And I've seen the dark side of the guy here in Iowa. And he is not – he's using God to get votes. And I have a real problem with that when you use the Bible as a means of winning. We're supposed to praise God and love God, not use God to win, not use God to – it's almost in Iowa, it's gotten to the point of where it's he who carries the biggest Bible and can quote the most scripture wins the Iowa caucuses. Well, I have a real problem with that. And just me personally, on a personal, spiritual, emotional level. And no, I don't buy Senator Cruz's apology at all, because he ordered those people to do that. His staff did. And there's no reason to apologize. They should have. They knew better. They were using CNN as a cover to say, well, CNN said it, so it must be true. Oh, come on. 3/4 of the time, you guys are chastising the media for inaccuracies. Now you're saying, oh, they're right because they reported it? No. If you want to know if Carson's dropping out, call the campaign. They would have told you. Right. Ted can call Ben on his cell phone right now. I promise you he's got the phone number. He could have called him up and said, Ben, CNN's reporting you're getting out. Is this true? Because if it is, I'd like to try to win some of your votes. Do you mind? And if he was getting out, I'm pretty sure Dr. Carson would say, yeah, go for it, Ted. We're dropping in the morning. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I got to tell you, it didn't sound particularly sincere to me either. And I don't think I don't think Dr. Carson was buying it either from the look on his face. He did the little gracious kind of bow thing, but you could tell that Ben's pretty upset about it too, and I don't blame him. Obviously, it did affect his placement there. How much of that do you think actually propelled Cruz to that top spot, though? Do you think that he got the majority of the support from folks that bought into that story? Or
I'm sure, I am certain that it propelled him to the tune of thousands of votes. There's no question about it. Because you have, we had 99 candidates. So we have, 275 caucus locations in the state, something like that, maybe more. And if you take 25 per location, you know, you're talking about 5,000 votes. And that would have been a 5,000 vote swing, and Trump would have won by. I knew Trump and Cruz were going to be close. I knew that. I actually thought Trump would win by probably 1, maybe 2% at the most, but I thought he would pull it out at the end. And as it were, it didn't. And it would have made the difference. And I think Trump would have won. I honestly think that scam propelled Cruz into the top spot. I did not see Cruz winning because he had made too many gaffes late. He had made too many mistakes late in the process, if you'll recall. And I don't recall what all of them were now. You probably do, but he made several very serious mistakes there at the end, right before the caucus day.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones that really had a lot of attention for Iowans was when his people were releasing the names of their neighbors and the recent voting records and the recent caucus participation in an effort to drive up participation. But it actually kind of served as an invasion on their neighbors' privacy, which, you know, I was one of those places where folks still appreciate their privacy. They may not care so much in places like New York City, but you get out and about a little further west, and folks still have an idea of what it means to be behind your fences, so to speak. You got your public place, and then you've got your private stuff, and voting records is supposed to be a private thing. I know that was a big deal going into the last couple of days, and, you know, it still wasn't real popular that Cruz was actively talking about trying to do away with subsidies for the ethanol farming. So there was a lot of reasons for Iowans not necessarily to want to support Cruz.
Well, that's absolutely correct, and you are correct. This state was livid over those mail-outs. It, Simon Conway, who is the major drive-time talk show fellow here at WHL Radio, drilled on that for, oh, God, it was days. He just pounded on that. So, I mean, he was angry, very angry, to be calling people out by name and putting their, you know, voting record up and all that. And the ethanol, too, was a big deal here. That was a very, very big deal because this state has, I believe it's $7 billion with a B, year impact on Iowa, and they have like 40,000 jobs here, and that's a big deal for Iowa. Iowa's not that big of a state and not that many people here, so $7 billion is a very large deal in revenue, and 40,000 jobs is a real big deal here, and you walk down that road of no ethanol, or you want to get rid of the ethanol, because what it actually does is it's not the ethanol so much, it's the stabilization of the corn prices, which is a big deal, because you have a bad year and the price of corn drops, you know, 10 cents a bushel, 15 cents a bushel or whatever. That's huge to a corn farmer farming 2,500 acres of corn. That is a big deal. And you're talking about the difference in him earning a living for the year and not earning a living. And with those ethanol, the government ethanol subsidies involved, it stabilizes those prices just like it does for the dairy guys. And they know that, you know, if I have 200 cows, I'm going to earn X amount of dollars next year. And they can base their family's future on that, right? And that's what
right.
the corn, same thing with the corn. And when you have these mass fluctuations like you do in soybeans or cotton or whatever the case may be, it can mean devastation for thousands of family farmers in the state, of which is the bulk of the state. And that's why ethanol is a big deal. So I don't mean to pound on ethanol, but I'm just trying to explain why it's a big deal. And when Cruz comes in here and says, oh, we can get rid of those. Well, that's fine. Except you're fixing to put thousands of people out of business. And that's not
that's
a good thing.
Not exactly the crowd to be preaching to at the time.
No,
especially going in,
no,
into
not.
The caucuses.
So that's why I honestly thought Trump. I thought Trump was going to carry it because of that. I really did. And he would have had it not been for the dirty pool.
Was there any other surprises on the Republican side before we switch over to talk about the Democrat a little bit?
You talking about in Iowa?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Or
anything that surprised
okay.
you?
Anything that surprised me? Rubio's sudden rise. Rubio suddenly coming on as strong as he did, and I'm very sorry for the dog barking.
All right.
But Rubio came on really strong in the last week. And the other one that for me was Trump's weak ground game. I honestly thought that with Chuck Lochner, him hiring Chuck Lochner, he would have dominated Iowa, because nobody knows Iowa better than Chuck Lochner does. You know, he won it for Huckabee. He won it for Sam Torum came here with $30,000 in his pocket, and he was a senator that nobody had ever heard of in Iowa. Nobody knew who this guy was. And when Lochner got done with him, he won the caucuses. So what does that tell you? So nobody knows Iowa better than Lochner. And Lochner just flat, he made the mistake of hiring some friends of his. They had an opportunity. There were several organizations of which you're familiar with, one or two of them, that were offering busloads of volunteers for the Trump campaign. And they didn't want them. Stunned me. That absolutely stunned me. You know, here they were offering these volunteers to you to go to work and help you in your campaign. You don't want them? What's wrong with you people?
Yeah, that does sound pretty hard.
That really, yeah. Well, it was arrogance. They didn't want them. They didn't need them. They said, we got our own. Because they were going to these events and they were signing up people by the thousands on volunteer cards. The problem was they didn't have anybody to call them. They didn't have anybody to put them in the right spots. They didn't have anybody to work them. And these other organizations, these grassroots organizations, were going to do all that for them. And they didn't want them. And you saw what happened. So, yeah,
that
was surprising.
Just a gross miscalculation, or is there something else? Because it almost defies all political...
Arrogance. It was pure arrogance. We don't need you. We are Donald Trump. And that's what it was. And I've said all along, if anything brings down Trump in this campaign, it'll be his ego.
Yeah. All right. Well, as far as on the other side, the way the caucus worked out for the Democrats, of course, a lot of people made a big deal about the multiple coin flips and all that kind of. What do you think we learned about Hillary's strength from the Iowa caucus?
I think we learned that Hillary's not near as strong as the Democrat Party, and Hillary wants us to think Hillary is. I think Hillary's got a big problem, and his name is Bernie. And I think he got. And one of the funny things was the more Bernie talked, the further to the left Hillary went. And I found that to be quite comical, actually. You know, oh, you're only going to give away a trillion. Watch me. I can give away 2 trillion. Oh, you want to go to college? We're going to pay for your PhD at Harvard. Come on, I'll take care of it, you know.
Right.
It's funny to watch them try to outgive the other one away. Nobody ever bothered to ask a dumb question. How do you guys plan on paying for this? You know, you say, we don't have enough rich people to pay for this, guys. We can tax them 100% of their income, and there ain't enough of them. How do you really plan on paying for this? Nobody bothers to ask that question. So, anyway, it's, we're going to make Wall Street pay their fair share. Well, what you're trying to give away, you're going to bankrupt Wall Street in about 2 weeks. You know?
They're not real good. They're not real good at the math side of how you actually pay for things. That much has been clear for a long time. But if you're Hillary Clinton.
The other one, Tim, that's so funny, I cut you off for 1 second and say this. You got a Republican House. You got a Republican House that controls the checkbook. Do you honestly think Paul Ryan or the Senate or anybody else is just going to give you a totally blank checkbook for the next 4 years? To run up another $7, $8, $10 trillion in debt? I don't think so. I mean, I can be wrong, Paul Ryan, you know that, but
yeah.
I just don't see it happening. I don't see it happening.
I would hope not, but I have yet to see this Republican-controlled House or Senate do anything to stop the Obama objective. So until I see them put a halt on some of that spending, I'm not going to have much confidence that they're going to actually take control of the purse strings like they should. So who knows?
It's a scary thing. I don't see them. I don't, personally speaking, I don't see the Democrats winning anyway. I think we are. It's pretty clear now that it was clear to me, but, it's going to be one of four people. It's going to be the nominee. One of those four people is going to select Kasich or Santorum probably as a running mate so that they can carry Ohio and Pennsylvania. And they'll carry Florida. Because it doesn't matter if it's Rubio or it's Jeb or whoever, they're going to carry Florida. And Kasich will give them those big states that they need up there. And I can tell you now, Iowa's going to go back red. Colorado's going to go back red. So I'm pretty confident we're going to win the general election. So I think I think they're in trouble. I think Barack Obama has destroyed the Democrat Party for at least the next 8 years, probably 12 to 16 years. I just don't see America being willing to endure any more liberalism for some time. Not at this level. They could have withstood Bill Clinton liberalism or a Bill Clinton-type Democrat, but not what we've had. This is over-the-top ridiculous, and I think America's sick of it, and I think you're fixing to see a revolt happen.
Well, I certainly hope so, at any rate, because it's a little past time.
I agree with you, my friend.
Well, real quick, before we run out of time with you, and I want to try and get you out of here right about 4, so we've only got about a minute or so, but if you run a little long, it's okay. What do you suspect we're going to see as far as the New Hampshire primary? Are we going to see a little more of the same, or are we going to get any other new surprises? What do you think is about to happen?
I think you're going to see Trump win by probably 5 points in New Hampshire, 3 to 5 points. Over, and I think it's a coin flip between John Kasich and Chris Christie for second. Christie's doing very well up there. Rubio's doing very well up there. Kasich, from everything I'm hearing, has the best ground game in the state. And you even saw Trump out yesterday and today actually walking into restaurants and doing the old retail thing that you have to do in New Hampshire and Iowa. He's finally learning that, you know, hey, I can't just do stadiums. I've got to actually get out here and shake hands. And he's doing that. And that's a good thing. Too little, too late? I don't think so. I think Trump's messaging is resonating. I think people are anti-status quo, particularly in New Hampshire. They're sort of rebellious up there, if you'll remember. They're some of the ones that started all this stuff back in 1776. So they've been doing it for a while. They know how to rebel. I think you're going to see a very strong outcome for Kasich and Christie up there. I really do. And I think Rubio will be right there in the hunt. I think Cruz is going to get blown out. We go to South Carolina. Trump owns South Carolina. He just flat owns it because of Jerry McDaniel down there. She's the head of the state Tea Party coalition. All the Tea Parties in the state belong to a coalition, and that's why they have a huge convention down there every year in Myrtle Beach. And this thing's big. I mean, it's even televised on C-SPAN and what have you. And Trump has done extraordinarily well, and she's the head of the Myrtle Beach and the South Carolina Tea Party Coalition. And they actually have, in that state, I'm told, as many Tea Party members as they do registered Democrats, or not Democrats, but registered Republicans. And so the Tea Party is a huge factor in South Carolina, and the Tea Party seems to be coalescing in South Carolina behind Trump, largely because of Jerry McDaniel. And Jerry McDaniel is the director of South Carolina campaign for Trump. And so you can guess which way they're all going. So after South Carolina, I think Cruz may be severely wounded. Rubio will still be picking up the middle. Jeb Bush, I don't think we've heard the last out of Jeb Bush. I think Jeb Bush is going to be, if I think he'll come in probably in the top three or four as well in New Hampshire and South Carolina. And he's got so much money behind him that I don't think we've heard the last of him either. The rest of them, I think, will go away after South Carolina. I think we'll be down to four. And then it'll be a dogfight going into Super Tuesday. But I think Trump will have the lead.
Super Tuesday will be where a lot of the donor money finally dries up. I do think you're probably right about Kasich and Christie doing real well in New Hampshire. I think last night's debate performance might actually move Christie ahead of Kasich for the folks that were watching and haven't been paying much attention to.
Oh, wasn't he great? Wasn't he great? He just did you see how he equated him to a Rocky movie? He nailed Rubio right in the ribs. I mean, he all but broke a couple of his ribs. Right out of the box, he had Rubio stumbling backwards all night long. He had him on the ropes. Did you see that?
I did. I did. You know, I said at the top of the show, if Chris Christie had been debating like that since the onset, he would probably be in a much stronger position right now. But, you know, the thing is, we're still just getting into the primary season, so he's still got time to move up. He may win back a lot of support that he lost over the little smooth fest with Obama. And I know back in the day when it first happened, you had the Hurricane Sandy hit and you had all this going on. I tried to downplay it a little bit here, saying that you expect your governor to go get whatever help he can go get in rebuilding your state. The criticism came with how chummy they looked and how many photo ops he gave, because that was really the very first time that Barack Obama had an opportunity to look the least bit presidential since he had held office. And that came via Christie. And that turned a lot of voters off nationwide. But last night's performance reminded people that he did, in fact, take on the teachers' union in his state. And he handled a lot of outside interference, a lot of the same reasons why I liked the Wisconsin governor as a early favorite before he dropped out early. And, you know, when people can withstand that much outside interference and still stand up and show that you got fire, fight, and you're willing to be accountable, which was the theme of the night for Christie, that being a senator doesn't make you accountable, being a governor does, it really seemed to resonate in the crowd, too.
I got to tell you, I agree wholeheartedly with you, and as for the photo ops and all that, look, unlike you, I never blamed Christie for that. Christie's going to go out and kiss whatever butt he's got to kiss to get the money to help his state. And I don't blame him for that. If it meant hugging him walking down the beach, if it meant kissing him on the cheek, I don't care. You know, hey, Governor, take care of us. Go do what's necessary here. He goes, well, I got to hug the guy and kiss the guy. Well, okay, fine. You know, whatever you got to do. I don't care. And he picked up, you know, $5 billion or whatever it was and helped recover. And that's what he had to do. That's the governor's job. I think Christie did an excellent job of explaining last night the differences in a senator's job and a governor's job. And people are starting to get it. I really think they're starting to get it. And last night's debate was also huge because it was on a big network. It wasn't MSNBC. It wasn't, you know, a cable. This was ADC primetime. And that's a big deal. And I think Christie, yeah, I think he knocked a home run last night. I think Kasich did well. I think Trump did exceedingly well last night. Trump probably had his best debate last night out of all of them. You know, I don't know who won. You know, it depends on who you talk to, I guess. But I really like Christie's showing last night. I think he did well. I think it helped him enormously well, a lot, enormously.
Well, from my point of view, I think Christie probably was the winner of the night. I've heard some people say Cruz was, but I wasn't particularly impressed with Cruz last night. And I have been somebody that's leaned towards Cruz in the past. But I really don't think he had a particularly good night. I don't see how anybody could claim he was the winner. Kasich, I think, had a decent night, but I still think he was kind of left out to the corner a lot on the questions that he could have made the most hay with. The mediator seemed to stay away from him. I think Jeb Bush had a pretty good night.
He did. Jeb did well. I agree with you. Jeb did very well. I would give Jeb a B+. I'd give Christie an A+.
Last night was really the first night that I've seen that it looks like Jeb really wants the job. You know, we've talked about it before when you've been on. There's been a lot of times where Jeb hasn't necessarily looked like his heart's really been in it. Last night, he looked like he really might actually want to be president for the first time.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think he did a good job. I do. I think he helped himself. I really do. I think he helped himself. It's going to be interesting, my friend. Who's going to win the big game today?
Well, I'm going to be rooting for the Broncos. I got to pull for my man Peyton. But what I'm afraid
now,
of.
No, I didn't ask you who you were rooting for. I'm asking you who's going to win.
I'm afraid that Carolina offense might be a little too much for the Denver defense to keep in check. If the offensive line gives Peyton enough time to do his business, it should be real interesting. I think Carolina probably wins, but I'm going to be so rooting for the Broncos.
I agree with you. If that offensive line, if they can protect Peyton and give him 3 or 4 seconds every play, I think you've got a horse race. If not, I think we're going to get killed. I don't see us keeping up with a. I mean, the guy's what, 6'5" and 250 or 60, and he's pure athlete muscle. How do you stop a guy that runs like an antelope that can throw the ball with that on accuracy for 70 yards? How do you stop something like that? Yeah,
well, based on this year's record, obviously you don't.
Yeah, that's true enough. friend. It's been a pleasure. I gotta go eat some wings now. Get ready for the big game. But it's been a pleasure.
I appreciate you coming on again and giving up part of your Sunday, especially your Super Bowl Sunday, kid. And we'll have you back on again real soon, and we'll talk a little bit more as this wonderful process continues. Thank you very much, and God bless, sir.
You too, my friend. God bless you as well. Bye-bye now.
Goodbye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that, of course, was Ken Crow. He is the purveyor of Crow's Nest politics and activist in Tea Party politics, one of the co-founders of the TeaPartyCommunity.com, and very graciously giving up some of his time, and he's a real friend of the program, so I want to thank him again for coming on. You know, and we've talked about it, and see, conversation got started in the chat room while I was talking with Ken, and I want to give a special shout-out to Mary and to Russell Crow. Appreciate you guys being in there. Whoever the guests are listening in, thanks for being here and listening, and you're welcome to participate in the comments as well. You know, the results in Iowa are interesting. The fact that it appears that the Cruz campaign is willing to resort to dirty politics, which there's really no other way to put that, I think says a lot about the character of the campaign. Ted says he wasn't aware that that happened until after the fact. And, you know, it's hard to imagine that wouldn't have got run by him. But, you know, at the same time, I can't say for sure 100% that, yeah, even though he should have known, did he know? I don't know. Maybe he didn't. Maybe his apology publicly, both previous to this and in last night's debate, was legitimate. But regardless, it's still dirty politics. CNN may have reported this. But, like Ken pointed out, since when do you take CNN as the gospel? We spend a great deal of time talking about how bad the mainstream media is. Is that the single reason why Cruz propelled ahead of Trump, come in first, garnered that momentum? Don't know. But as things proceed and the state attorney general continues to look at whether or not there was a criminal activity involved, and as they continue to look at whether or not they're going to be able to certify those results, some of those delegates could be taken away. And at the end of the day, Trump may end up being the winner anyway. It's a shame that this happened and the way it happened. It taints what would have been a good win for either Cruz or Trump had it prevailed the way it should have. It also was very hurtful to the Ben Carson campaign, because there's no question, if it swayed as many votes as Ken seems to think they did, and he was there, I mean, he is an Iowan, he was participating. So that's part of the reason why I wanted to have him on to talk about what happened in Iowa, because I know not only is he all plugged into all these different folks, but he was actually participating in this. And the caucus system is very different from just a standard primaries, and a lot of folks still aren't real clear on the fact that you get to go in and you get to talk for your candidate, and you're trying to convince folks to come to your side. You know, it's not like you just walk into a booth. It's muddied the water more than it's cleared things up, the fact that this event happened. And the person hurt most by it is Ben Carson. Ben is a guy that still deserves to be in the conversation. Russell in the chat room brings up a good point. We've yet to hear from a single Carson caucuser who changed his vote because of the CNN story. That may very well be the case. I don't imagine these folks would be coming out and admitting that that's what happened to them at this point, though, especially if they find out they've been duped. I think a lot of the anger that comes from this is probably people who would have caucused for Carson that didn't. But, you know, again, I could be wrong. I'm not in Iowa, so who knows? bottom line here is it's still early on, and Super Tuesday is usually where a lot of the dust really settles. This is just the beginning of the process. Like Ken mentioned, I think it's absolutely hilarious to watch the Democrats at this stage, seeing who can outgive. How much can we give away? You're only going to give this. You're only going to give that. I'll give you this much. And none of the people that are supporting those people are talking about things like FBI investigating Hillary, for example. At this point, I don't see how Hillary doesn't end up being indicted. But the woman has been Teflon for a long time. She knows how to get around legal issues. She's lied to the American public when it came to Benghazi. She lied to the families of those fallen men. I really, really don't understand how this woman continues to garner support. How far gone is the Democratic National Party at this point that Hillary Clinton can even have an opportunity to be their nominee? How far gone is this party that her chief competitor is a devout socialist? To me, it's a scary thing that the country's went far enough to the left that a socialist or Hillary could possibly be their nominee. Anyway, we'll have a chance next week to talk about what happened in New Hampshire, so we will. And, of course, like I mentioned at the top of the show, going to do a much shorter show than usual today. So I'm going to be looking to hop on out of here in just a few minutes. But before I did, there was another story from last week that I didn't get to that I wanted to at least mention, and we'll go into in-depth a little bit more probably next week. And that is this continuing story of what happened with the people who blew the whistle on Planned Parenthood. Now, during the course of the series of videos that we've all been talking about for a while now, Planned Parenthood had top people exposed for violating federal and, in many cases, state laws by selling fetal tissue and targeting particular tissue. So far, nothing criminal has been moved forward against Planned Parenthood. However, the individuals involved with bringing these videos to light have officially been charged for tampering with government IDs because they used fake IDs to get their way into the positions for these meetings. They're being charged and indicted. We'll see where the dust settles because they took the action to expose Planned Parenthood. And I talked about this online, but not on air when it happened. Like I said, last week's show would have been the first time I would have had a chance since that happened. And I get that if you're going to be about law and order, you have to know that sometimes that scale swings both ways and sometimes the sword cuts both ways. There should, in fact, be some ramifications for breaking the law, even if you do it for a good reason. Now, does this fake ID bit raise to the level of an indictment given what it was done for? You can argue the morality of that all day long, but I'm willing to accept a society that will punish them for that violation as long as that same society is going to take the necessary steps to enforce the law that was exposed as being violated by the Planned Parenthood people. You don't want to hold the organization in its total accountable? Fine. But the individuals that they caught the individuals that bragged about how they wanted to drive a certain kind of car, so they needed to pump up the values. They tried to negotiate higher dollar amounts. They were guaranteed specific tissues would be available. These people need to be held accountable, at least personally. If you're not willing to do that, then why are we going to punish anyone in this? I want the law to cut both ways. I want law and order to be established and maintained and in place. I do. I don't think a fake ID is that big of a deal unless you're using it to illegally buy cigarettes or alcohol. And in that case, it's still a local issue. These people faked documents, government IDs, for the purpose of exposing a far greater crime, one that most of us as conservatives paid attention and know the history of Planned Parenthood, probably already knew. But knowing that the majority of the American public in its whole doesn't have time to pay attention to. We're too busy with our family lives, our work lives, and whatever recreational activities we have going on, whether it's watching television, participating in sports, or, you know, whatever it might be. Most Americans just aren't paying attention. These folks took it upon themselves to do something that they knew that the Facebook crowd and the social media crowd wouldn't miss. There was a rage and an anger in this country that hadn't been felt in a long time, and there was an awakening to the brutality of the practice of abortion in this country. Even now, we have the Los Angeles Times printing stories about since Texas has stopped funding Planned Parenthood, the birth rate has shot up for among women who would have been utilizing Planned Parenthood. They're trying to make it sound as if it's a lack of health services and a lack of birth control, I suppose, is part of the argument that has created this new issue. They're trying to start the PR campaign to get Planned Parenthood back on all the tax rolls across the country. And so few people are still blind to the issue that Planned Parenthood began as a eugenicist organization with the intent of eliminating blacks. Every time I've talked to a Black Lives Matter person in the past 3 months, I have asked them, how can black lives really matter as long as Planned Parenthood still exists? Fortunately, I can report that over the course of the last two times that I mentioned it, they did know exactly what I was talking about. Unfortunately, the several dozen times before that, they had no clue. Most people have no clue. Most of the folks that listen to this show, listen to Underground Professor, listen to the Exceptional Conservative shows, these folks, they know this information because there are people out there who have known it for some time and who continue to try and inform the public in general. And if you will listen to these shows, you're going to get a lot of great information, not to mention the fact that it's some pretty decent entertainment, too. If you're not already listening to those guys, I recommend that you do check them out and check out the archives. Ultimately, though, this is a case where the law is being used as a weapon to silence. Mary in the chat room says she never misses those songs. The law is being used to silence these individuals who are crusaders trying to bring a true crime tonight. In fact, Mary is pointing out in the chat room right now that the professor is on tonight. These crusaders were trying to bring a true crime against humanity to light. Russell in the chat room mentions that Mary Sanger was one of Hillary's heroes, was the founder of Planned Parenthood. founded it with the help of the KKK expressly to terminate blacks. And yes, they were specifically put in communities that were high percentage blacks. It was done intentionally. It was created for the express purpose of eliminating what Ms. Sanger referred to as undesirables. And yes, Hillary Clinton is on record as having said that Margaret Sanger is one of her heroes. And we even talked about that to a degree back when they were talking about trying to take Andrew Jackson off of the $20 bill and they wanted to put women on it, how Margaret Sanger was one of the women on the list of possible replacements. Although evidently they're actually going to leave Andrew alone now and they're going to put some women on some $10 bills. I don't think they've made a final decision yet. Of course, we talked about that, too, several weeks back. Actually, I guess it's been a few months at this point, but don't think they made a final determination as far as who they're going to put on the $10 bill. And at this point, evidently, it's not going to be a permanent change either, and they're going to kind of rotate it kind of like what they did with the state quarters bit. That, I think, is somewhat interesting, actually, but, you know, we'll see how that plays out. I'm not opposed to having some women on some money. We have a lot of great women in American history. Margaret Sanger, however, is not one of them. Not when you get to know her and who she was and what she stood for. And Planned Parenthood is still that. It's been sold to the American public, especially through the 80s, as something that was worthy of tax dollars because it was going to protect American families, which, you know, we know now most of the folks on the left, whether they realize it or not, they support policies and government actions that actually do the opposite of protecting American families. Mary asks, why go through the expense of changing the currency? The currency is just a way they have of honoring people. And yeah, it's an expensive proposition, and unfortunately, given where our economy is going, there could very well be a time when the expense of making such a change could actually outpace the value of the bill itself. So it's a good question. But at the same time, I get wanting to honor certain people. The $10 bill seems like somebody the Treasury Department really wouldn't want to change since Hamilton was the first Secretary of the Treasury. But, you know, irony in it being what it is. Russell reiterates what I was saying earlier, that Planned Parenthood began as a eugenics organization, much like the Nazi Party, who would erase Martin Luther King or Ben Carson or Mandela from our history. Planned Parenthood and the Nazis would if they could. And, yeah, where its starting point was is absolutely that. Now, I have no doubt that within Planned Parenthood, there are certain low-level people that honestly believe they're helping people, and they're trying to do exactly that. The same as you have good, honest people working in the veterans, in the VA system. So I don't like painting with a broad brush everybody associated with these organizations, but there is no question the people up near the top have not lost track of the founding statement. You know, there was a planned purpose. They have a guiding principle. And Planned Parenthood's guiding principle has not changed. If it had, we'd see a change in how they conduct their business. So the fact that now we have folks that crusaded to bring this criminal activity to light, and they are now going to face criminal charges well before anyone associated with Planned Parenthood will, and well before we're going to see any federal defunding of Planned Parenthood, that it's only happening on a state-by-state basis, and Planned Parenthood is fighting back in lawsuits, some of which it looks like they might actually win on the state-by-state basis, keeping Medicare dollars out of the coffers. That's an outrage. It goes beyond my ability to express how outrageous it is. So there it is. I'd only plan on running until 4 today. It's 4:30 now. I got all of last week's stuff in now. Appreciate everybody for listening. Thank you very much. I've got to go spend some time with my family today, so I'm going to cut it off early right here. But I will be back next week at 3, and we'll have the full regular show going on. At this point, I'm not real sure who the guest is going to be. I do think I'm going to probably be reaching out to Daisy Donovan, and hopefully she'll be able to join in. She was originally scheduled to be with us for our show when we were taking a look back at the year that was. She wasn't able to make it then, so maybe we can get her on this time. In the meanwhile, you know what I always say, don't take my word for it. Definitely, definitely don't take their word for it. Take a little time. Be prepared to put in some effort. Do your own research, because you're going to have to work just a little bit if you really want to tap into the truth. That's it for this week, everybody. You have a blessed week upcoming. Special thanks again to Mary and to Russell for joining us this week. Good to see you in the chat room. Hopefully you can be back with us next week. And also, like Mary pointed out in the chat room earlier, Underground Professor will be on tonight. If you've got a chance to listen into his show, if you've never listened in particularly, definitely give it a listen. Check out the archives. He has some great shows. And be looking for some of the other hosts on here that are absolutely fantastic. A lot of information, a lot of entertainment, and a lot of great, great hosts that are out here at BTR. In the meanwhile, again, I'm going to have to sign out. And remember that we are definitely in need of a miracle. Goodbye, everybody.
Looking for a miracle.